The message you are about to hear was delivered by David Rothwell. And now, Mr. Rothwell.
It was just a couple of minutes past midnight when Hosni finally put down his writing instrument and picked up the lamp from the kitchen table where he had been working. And he made his way quietly through the darkened house towards the master bedroom. And as he passed the children's bedroom, he stuck his head in and noticed their sleeping bodies laying in the beds. And he moved to the bed where his wife, Seket, lay sleeping, and he quietly crawled underneath the sheets. And as he put his arms around her, he noticed that she seemed to lack the usual response to him snuggling up against her with his warm body. And at first he thought that she was just in a very deep sleep and didn't realize that he had gotten into bed. But after a few moments, he began to realize she wasn't breathing. And he cried out, and then he ran into the children's room to check on them, to wake them up, see if they were okay. And to his horror, he found that his 8-year-old son, their firstborn, was also dead. And he began to cry out even more loudly, and the wailing sound woke up the neighbors, and they too discovered that they had dead bodies in their household. Let's turn to Exodus chapter 12, and I want to read in verse 29. Exodus the 12th chapter in verse 29 we read, "And it came to pass that at midnight the Lord smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne unto the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead." To the Israelites in the land of Goshen, it must have sounded something like the distant sound of thunder, this great cry. I have sat in a stadium where there were 100,000 people, and when they all yelled at once, the sound was unbelievable. Can you imagine what the sound must have been like when in every single house in Egypt there were dead people that were sons, daughters, wives, husbands, and there was a great cry? It must have been an awesome thing. "And Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, 'Rise up and get forth from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said.'" Skip down to verse 37. "And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 on foot, that were men besides children." So this was a large group of people. "And a mixed multitude went up with them, flocks and herds and very much cattle. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they brought forth out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry, neither had they prepared for themselves any victual." "Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years, and it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night to be much observed to the Lord for bringing them out from the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord to be observed of all the children of Israel in their generations. And so God delivered the Israelites out of Egypt from the slavery that they had been in for many years. And last night, we celebrated the night to be much observed in remembrance of this night that God delivered the Israelites. And today we celebrate the first day of unleavened bread. And we, like the Israelites who ate unleavened bread because they were thrust out of Egypt so quickly that they didn't have time to let the dough leaven, we also eat unleavened bread. And the unleavened bread symbolizes the fact that we are working to put sin out of our lives. Leaven is used in the Bible as a type of sin. Egypt is used in the Bible as a type of sin. And as we look at the story of the Israelites coming out of the land of Egypt, this type of sin, there are lessons that we can learn in our lives about coming out of sin. And what I want to do today is look at a couple of lessons that we can learn from the story of the Exodus of the Israelites out of Egypt. Because if we understand what it is that God's doing in our lives, we can make some sense out of what's going on around us. And this can also act as a roadmap for the future for us. The first lesson that I want to look at about coming out of sin is that if we're going to come out of sin, we must recognize who the true God is. We must recognize the true God. God destroyed all the Egyptians' false gods. And in one sense, when you look at the story of the Exodus, this is a story about a showdown between God, the true God, and the false gods. And this is borne out by the fact that when you think about who is behind the false gods, well, it's Satan, the serpent. And what was the first thing that God had Moses do in the presence of Pharaoh? Well, it was he cast down his rod and it became a serpent. And then Pharaoh's magicians cast down their rods, which also were serpents. And God's serpent ate up the other serpents. And this should have been sort of a warning, a foreshadowing to them of what was to come. The Egyptians worshipped a plethora of various gods. They worshipped one particular god that was called Ijo, which was a serpent god. And in this instance of the rod that Moses cast down that became a serpent eating it up, it was the beginning of God demonstrating his power as opposed to the power of the false gods. And I think one misconception that we may have due to Hollywood is we think that perhaps these magicians that were in Pharaoh's employ were just that, magicians. You know, like doing sleight of hand and illusions that there's some technical explanation for. I don't believe this is true. We find out, we know the names of at least two of them, Jannes and Jambres, because in the New Testament it talks about Jannes and Jambres withstanding Moses. And I'll get to something in a few minutes here, which I think will be additional proof that these were more than just guys doing sleight of hand tricks. These were guys that had supernatural power from the dark side, if you will. Go to Exodus chapter 9 and verse 14. I want to support the fact that this was, in fact, as I said, a showdown and a way for God to prove and show who he was. Exodus chapter 9, and let's begin reading in verse 13. Verse 13 of Exodus 9, and the Lord said to Moses, "Rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For I will at this time send all my plagues upon your heart and upon your servants and upon your people. Why? That you may know that there is none like me in all the earth.'" They worshipped things of the earth. They worshipped the creation. They worshipped animals and various things that were part of the physical creation. And God says, "I'm going to let you know that I am far more powerful than anything in the earth." You remember what the very first plague was? It was turning the Nile into blood. The Egyptians worshipped the Nile. They had numerous gods that were connected with the Nile. One of them was a god called Hapi, who supposedly, when the Nile would overflow its banks every year during the flood season, this god was responsible for that. There was a number of different goddesses. Apet, Bast, Mut, Anuket, Tuart. These were some titles of goddesses that supposedly were associated with the Nile. They thought that the waters of the Nile River were sacred and that there was some supernatural power. You see, the Nile gave them life. It was the water that allowed them to drink and for their crops. And God, in a sense, was saying, "You think that this Nile River has some special power, that it's supernatural, that it's sacred, and that it gives life? I'll turn it into blood." Blood being a symbol of life, but the outpouring of blood being death. It killed everything in the river. And then the magicians of Pharaoh turned water into blood. They dug around. It says, you read in Exodus, they dug around the river and were able to get fresh water. And they turned water into blood. And this was not just some sleight of hand. They actually turned water into blood. Then the next plague, the plague of frogs. The Egyptians worshipped a frog god called Hecate. And again, here was God saying, you think that this frog that you worship is some kind of supernatural, powerful god? I will send so many frogs on you that you're sick of frogs. And again, the magicians of Pharaoh, they produced frogs. Now, at this point, you got to wonder, how happy is Pharaoh with his magicians? I mean, you got to believe that perhaps at this point he was taking them aside and saying, listen, guys, we got enough frogs. Maybe instead of making more frogs, you could make some of them go away. Third plague was the lice. Now, this is an interesting one because the Egyptians did not worship lice. In fact, they were very much opposed to lice. And this is kind of an interesting twist on how God was teaching them that their gods were nothing. You see, in their pagan religious practice, if anybody had lice, they were not allowed to go into the temple for the special temple worship and ceremonies that they had. So the priests would every third day shave their heads and shave all the hair off their body so that there was no chance that they could get lice. Well, God sent lice, and they couldn't get rid of the lice, and they were prevented, therefore, from worshiping their false gods because they had lice. Now, at this point in the story, it's interesting to note, this is the point at which Pharaoh's magicians gave up. God, you know, with Satan, God limits Satan's power. He gives him so much and says no more. And at this point, God did not allow them to have the power to produce lice. They said, we can't. They tried to produce lice out of the dust. You know, Moses picked up dust and threw it in the air and it became lice. And they said, we cannot do this. Now, if they were just sleight-of-hand magicians, how easy would it have been to have... I mean, there was lice everywhere. You have some lice in your hand, you pick up some dust, you know, you conceal the lice, you throw the dust, and it says, see, it's lice. They said, we can't do this. This would have been the simplest of all the tricks to do. And they said, this is the finger of God. They recognized that something was going on here. They couldn't do what they normally were able to do. The next plague was flies. And again, the Egyptians did not worship flies, but there was a season in Egypt every year where they got a plague of flies. It was really bad. And they worshiped Beelzebub, who was the god of flies, and they would pray to Beelzebub saying, take the flies away. And of course, it was a cyclical, you know, seasonal thing, and the flies would come, and then the flies would leave every year. And they attributed this to their prayers to Beelzebub, the god of flies, who supposedly protected them from flies. Well, again, God says, you think that Beelzebub has some special power? You think this god of flies is something? I'll send flies. Pray to them all you want. They're not leaving. And they were infested with flies. The next plague was the murrain of the cattle, where all the cattle and domestic beasts of the field died, or many of them died, were smitten with this murrain, which is some type of a disease for cattle. And again, this was a god that the Egyptians worshipped. They worshipped cattle. They had several gods. One was called Hathor. One was called Apis. These were cows and bulls that they worshipped as gods. And this, again, was God saying, hey, you think this is some kind of a deity? I'll kill them. Plague 6, boils on man and beast. Some experts theorize, you know, Moses, it says that God instructed Moses to take ashes from the furnace and throw them in the air, and then it became boils. Many experts theorize that the ashes came from a furnace where they had done human sacrifices to try to appease their gods and ward off these plagues. So again, you know, the Egyptians had all kinds of gods to protect all different parts of their body. They had gods to protect their insides. They had gods to protect their arms and their legs and different things. And here they had made possibly, if this is true, they had done human sacrifices to try to, you know, get the power of these gods on their side to dispel these plagues. And Moses takes the ashes out of this very altar in this furnace and throws in the air and it becomes boiled. And they have no protection. The seventh was the hail. They worshipped Tefnut, the goddess of moisture and clouds. And again, it's turned against them. Torrential rains and huge hail that if you were caught outside would kill you. Plague eight was the locusts, which God calls his great army. The locusts came and ate up all whatever was left after the hail had beat down the crops in the field. And again, they had all these gods to protect them from these things. Gods to protect the crops. But they were powerless. The ninth plague was the darkness. And probably the most prominent or pervasive god that the Egyptians had was the god Ra, the sun god. Here was a god who supposedly was the sun and represented the sun. And God, again, showed them how powerless their gods were. He took this away from them. He took the sun away for 3 days. It was so dark that it says that the Egyptians saw not one another for 3 days. Can you imagine it being so dark that you're sitting down next to your husband or your wife or your children and you can't even see them? They said it was so dark you could feel it. But you know what? The Israelites had light in the land of Goshen. And in fact, after the third plague, none of the other plagues had any effect on the Israelites. They were protected. The tenth plague, of course, was the death of the firstborn. And this was the final stroke that caused Pharaoh and all the Egyptians to send the Israelites out. Well, the Egyptians worshipped the Pharaoh as a god. So if you think about it, the firstborn of Pharaoh was the next in line to be the next god, and he was killed. So all these plagues that God brought was one by one systematically breaking down and destroying this false system of worship and showing that these gods that they worshiped were nothing and that he was the all-powerful true God. God will destroy the false gods in our lives, in our minds as well. And this is the lesson for us, is as we look at what God had to do in Egypt to free the Israelites from the slavery of sin, God must do the same thing in our lives to free us from the slavery of sin. He must destroy the false gods and the idols that we have in our minds. And God will accept nothing short of absolute and unconditional surrender to him in this regard. You know, early on, as the plagues were progressing, Pharaoh told Moses, he said, look, you can go ahead and go worship, but just don't go very far. It was a conditional surrender, and it wasn't good enough. And God doesn't want conditional surrender from us. He doesn't want us saying, okay, God, I will obey you in all areas except this one. It's got to be unconditional. I'll tell you a story about a man that some of us in this room are quite familiar with and others may not be so much, because I believe that he demonstrated in his life a surrender and a process of repentance to God where the false gods and the idols in his life were destroyed. And he wrote about it in a book, which I believe, well, in my life was the most influential book in my life after the Bible. And I'm talking about Herbert Armstrong. And as many of you know, Herbert Armstrong was a man that God began working with back in the 1920s. And he was a very successful young man. And his God, if you will, his idol in his life was he wanted to be thought of as successful and respected by other rich and powerful men. And I'm going to quote a couple things from his autobiography. He had been working as a publisher's rep in Chicago, making a lot of money for that day, especially for a man who was only 28 years old. And it was all swept away from him in the flash depression of 1920. And for a number of years, he struggled financially. And then on top of that, his wife, whom he loved very much, got involved with this crazy religion where they believed that you went to church on Saturday. And she challenged him on this, and he said, "I'm going to prove you wrong," to his wife, Loma. He says, "Finally, after 6 months, the truth had become crystal clear. At last, I knew what was the truth. Once again, God had taken me to a licking. It had been bewildering, utterly frustrating. It seemed as if some mysterious, invisible hand was disintegrating every business I started." That was precisely what was happening. The hand of God was taking away every activity on which my heart had been set, the business success before whose shrine I had worshipped. This zeal to become important in the business world had become an idol. God was destroying the idol. He was knocking me down again and again. He was puncturing the ego, deflating the vanity. Herbert Armstrong, at age 16, had taken a job as a high school student, and his employer told him that he thought he had potential to do really well in the world of business. And it awakened an ambition in him, and he really wanted to become successful. And he started taking jobs that would teach him and educate him and bring him in contact with the rich and the powerful. And as I said, by age 28, he had built a publisher's rep business that gave him an income that was extraordinary for that time. But the flash depression of 1920 swept it all away. He struggled financially. He had to move in with his wife's relatives, which was terribly humiliating for him. And about 5 or 6 years later, they were living in Oregon, and he started another business. And this was, he was an ad rep for a chain of laundry stores. And within a fairly short period of time, it was so successful because he was really good at what he did. He was earning $1,000 a month, which back then was a considerable amount of money. And he said that he could see going national with this thing because his ad campaign was improving the businesses for this chain of laundries that he was doing the ads for so much that he could see, he said, an income of up to $500,000 a year, which in the 1920s was just wealth beyond imagination. But again, through circumstances outside his control, it was taken away. There was a meeting of the National Laundry Association, and they made some ruling that took the whole business away from him. And then his wife challenged him on this matter of the Sabbath. And he had met with some of the people who were Sabbath keepers. And to him, they were kind of backwards, you know, kind of backwoods hillbilly types. He says, "It was humiliating to have to admit my wife had been right and I had been wrong in the most serious argument that ever came between us. The opening of my eyes to the truth brought me to the crossroads of my life. To accept it meant to throw in my lot with a class of humble and unpretentious people I had always looked upon as inferior. It meant being cut off from the high and the mighty and the wealthy of this world to which I had aspired. It meant the final crushing of vanity. It meant a total change of life. But I had been beaten down. God had brought that about, though I didn't realize it then. Repeated business reverses, failure after failure had destroyed self-confidence. I was broken in spirit. The self in me didn't want to die. It wanted to try to get up from ignominious defeat and try once again to tread the broad and popular way of vanity of this world. But now I knew that way was wrong. I knew its ultimate penalty was death, but I didn't want to die now. It truly was a battle for life, a life and death struggle. In the end, I lost that battle as I had been losing all worldly battles in recent years. Finally, in desperation, I threw myself on God's mercy. I said to God that I knew now that I was nothing but a burnt-out hunk of junk. My life was worth nothing more to me. I said to God, I knew now I had nothing to offer Him, but if He would forgive me, if He could have any use whatsoever for such a worthless dreg of humanity, that He could have my life. I wanted to accept Jesus Christ as personal Savior." Let's turn to Luke chapter 9. Luke, the 9th chapter. Luke chapter 9 and verse 24. The words of Jesus Christ. Luke chapter 9, verse 24. "For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save it." Finally, Herbert Armstrong writes, this surrender to God, this repentance, this giving up of the world, of friends and associates and everything, was the most bitter pill I ever swallowed. Yet it was the only medicine in all my life that ever brought a healing. Just as God brought the nation of Egypt to its knees before they were finally willing to give up and surrender and allow the Israelites to go free out of slavery, God, if He's working in our lives, will bring us to our knees through the crushing of the idols, the false gods that we have in our minds until we are finally ready to come out of sin. This brings me to the second lesson that we can learn from the Israelites coming out of sin, leaving Egypt, and that is, to come out of sin, we must work at it. To come out of sin, we must work at it. Can you imagine what it would be like? I mean, we read a bit earlier that there were 600,000 men besides children. It's been estimated that you have a group of about 2 million people here. So imagine a group of people that large, and imagine them having to move on foot from one place to another. I mean, I don't know about you, but moving is one of the most horrendous experiences that I've ever been through in my life. I hate it. I really hate moving. In fact, just packing for a trip, Marilyn, you can probably relate to this. You have young children. Just if you're going to go to the feast or go on a short trip, just the effort of packing the clothes, getting the kids together, getting the car loaded, it's horrendous, isn't it? It's just exhausting. Can you imagine if you were the Israelites, there's about 2 million of you, and God is delivering you out of Egypt, this type of sin, but He doesn't supernaturally just transport you away to another place. He's supernaturally done all these miracles and plagues to deliver you, but you, as an Israelite, still have work to do. You have to walk. You have to, every day, pick up all your belongings, whatever, you know, carry everything, and get all your family, all your kids, all your animals, and you move every day. Let's go to Numbers chapter 33. Begin reading in verse 1. These are the journeys of the children of Israel, which went forth out of the land of Egypt with their armies under the hand of Moses and Aaron. And Moses wrote their goings out according to their journeys by the commandment of the Lord, and these are their journeys according to their goings out. And they departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, that's today. On the morrow after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with a high hand in the sight of all the Egyptians. For the Egyptians buried their firstborn, which the Lord had smitten among them upon their gods, and the Lord executed judgment. Also the Lord executed judgment. And the children of Israel removed from Ramses and pitched in Succoth. So first of all, they had to pick up all their belongings from their homes, and they went to the gathering place at Ramses. And then after they got settled in Ramses, then they moved to Succoth. And they departed from Succoth and pitched in Etham, which is in the edge of the wilderness. And then they removed from Etham and turned again to Pihahiroth, which is before Baal-zephon, they pitched before Migdal, and they departed from before Pihahiroth and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness and went 3 days' journey into the wilderness of Etham and pitched in Marah. So you can see even by the time they just got to the Red Sea, they'd moved 3 or 4 times. This was a lot of work. And the lesson for us is that God will work supernaturally in our lives and work miracles for us to bring us out of sin by destroying the false gods and the idols that we have in our lives and our minds, but He doesn't do all the work for us. There's work that we have to do, just like the Israelites had to walk. And we're told that God bore them on eagle's wings, but doesn't mean that they flew in an airplane. They walked. It's a joint effort. We read in Isaiah chapter 64, verse 6, that our righteousness is as filthy rags. But you know what? In Revelation chapter 19, we read about that to the saints it was granted that they would wear fine linen. And this fine linen is the righteousness of the saints. It's God's righteousness which he puts in us. And through a joint effort between God working miraculously in our lives and the effort that we put forth working at it, God gives us his righteousness. And that righteousness is not filthy rags. It is fine linen. And it reflects God's glory. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 uses an agrarian example. And I think it makes it easier for us to understand this dichotomy of the fact that on the one hand, only God can deliver us from sin, and it's only God's righteousness that counts for anything. But on the other hand, we have to work at it too. We have our part in it. And the analogy is this. If you're a farmer, you recognize the fact that if you don't go out and plow the ground, if you don't plant some seed in the ground, and if you don't fertilize it, you don't water it, you don't cultivate it, you're not going to get a crop, right? And then after you have the crop, you've got to go out and harvest it. So there's a lot of work that you as a farmer have to do. But you know what? You do not make that seed grow. You can't do that. This is a miracle that God has created, that you take a dead seed, you put it in the ground, you cover it up, and then through the water and the warmth and the sunshine and the nutrients in the soil, somehow it comes back to life, it sprouts up, and then it bears food. This is a miracle. God made that. God does that part. But the farmer has his part too, right? We read in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, in verse 6, Paul says, I have planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. And it's exactly the same in our lives. We have to do the planting and the watering, but it's God that gives the increase. Mr. Armstrong put it most succinctly, I think, when he said, we have to work at it as if it all depended on us, but we have to pray about it as if it all depended on God. The third lesson that we can learn from the Israelites coming out of Egypt, coming out of sin, is that to come out of sin, we have to go where God leads us. The Israelites did not like some of the places where God led them. Let's go to Exodus chapter 13. Exodus chapter 13, the Israelites had a pillar of cloud by day that they followed, which became a pillar of fire at night. And this is how they were led out of the land of Egypt. But despite the fact that they knew that this cloud was a supernatural manifestation from God, despite the fact that they had seen the incredible miracles that God performed in Egypt to free them from slavery, they still didn't like, and they still griped about where the cloud led them. I guess that's human nature for you. Exodus chapter 13, verse 17. And it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go that God led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war and they return to Egypt. So God had some empathy for the people and didn't want to put them through more than they could handle. But God led the people about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up harnessed out of the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straitly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones hence with you. And they took their journey from Succoth and encamped in Etham in the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them by the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of the cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. So again, you would think that having this sign from God would reassure them. They would feel like, you know, I'll just go wherever God leads me, and God's there to take care of me. But it wasn't the case. Because what happened was that the Israelites got up to the edge of the Red Sea, and then they turned around and they saw that Pharaoh and his huge army that Pharaoh had assembled were coming after them. Chapter 14, verse 10. Notice the response of the Israelites. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore have you dealt with us with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is this not the word we did tell you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? They would have been, at this point, they were saying, hey, you know, the slavery thing may not have been so bad. You know, at least we were alive. Do we ever do the same thing in our lives when God is leading us to different places? Do we ever have this response to God? You know, why did you bring me here to die? Why have you dealt thus with me? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. I bet any of us who've ever been in a position of leadership have experienced this type of response from some people. Isn't that right, Mr. Bradick? There's always those times when you're in the leadership role and you say, okay, we're going to do this, and there's always somebody in the group that doesn't quite have the vision of why you're doing it the way you're doing it or why you are there, and this is their response is, you know, why have you dealt thus with us? Why have you brought us out in the wilderness to die? Exodus chapter 16. This is after they went through the Red Sea. So understand now, this is after they've seen an even more incredible miracle than anything they've seen before. Here was this huge Egyptian army on their tail, right behind them, that could have just wiped them all out. God opens up the Red Sea. So they're walking through the Red Sea on dry land, huge walls of water on either side of them. You know, and they're just, I mean, imagine doing this and you're looking around, you're thinking, whoa, this is unbelievable. The Egyptian army comes in, God lets the water come back and just crushes the Egyptian army. There's a big celebration. But yet, just a matter of days later, listen to them. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after the departing out of the land of Egypt. So this is just 30 days after they started leaving. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and when we did eat bread to the full. For you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. I mean, it's almost funny when you think about it. When you look back at it in hindsight, the way these people, they so quickly forgot who it was that was leading them. Chapter 17. And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, wherefore is this that you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? This is after the last time they complained that God gave them food to eat. And Moses cried to the Lord, saying, what shall I do to this people? They be almost ready to stone me. Is this how we ever react to God's leadership in our lives? Do we sometimes not like the places that God takes us? I would venture to say that's true. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations that are uncomfortable. We may find ourselves in a job situation that we don't like, or a lack of a job situation that we don't like, a family situation, a health situation. There's many things that we go through in our lives and they're not comfortable for us. And we have to recognize that God is leading us through this life. We don't have a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire to follow. We walk by faith, not by sight. But just as God gave the Israelites this pillar of cloud to lead them and to be there with them, God gives us a comforter. We read the other night at the Passover ceremony about Jesus said that when I go, I will not leave you alone. I will send you a comforter. We have God's Spirit. God is leading us, and God is taking us places. And our attitude needs to be, what can I learn from this situation that I'm in, as opposed to, God, why have you brought me out into the wilderness to die? Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11 is a chapter about faith and about the faithful And towards the end of the chapter, it talks a little bit about the experiences that many of the faithful have gone through in their lives. And as we read this, let's reflect on the circumstances that we find ourselves in and the trials and difficulties that we go through, and then contrast it with what it says here. Verse 32, "And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and of Samson and of Jephthah, of David and of Samuel and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword." Oh, all of a sudden here it goes from, you know, subduing kingdoms and things. Now, all of a sudden you find out that these people didn't always have it, you know, real easy and comfortable in their lives. They escaped the edge of the sword, but, you know, they escaped. But, you know, to have to escape the edge of the sword is uncomfortable. "Out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yes, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they, without us, should not be made perfect." So if we reflect on the circumstances we find ourselves in our lives, think about what some of the faithful went through. They didn't have it easy either. Turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians 11, the Apostle Paul talks a little bit about some of the experiences he went through in his life. Now, the Apostle Paul was somebody who no doubt came from an affluent background. He was well respected in the Jewish community. He got a first-rate education, which is usually an indication that your parents have some means. So he had a pretty comfortable life. He was not born into poverty. But listen to the Apostle Paul describe his life after his conversion. Verse 24 of chapter 11, 2 Corinthians. "Of the Jews, five times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned." Stoned and left for dead one time. "Three times I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day have I been in the deep. In journeyings often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils by my own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness, in painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness." Quite a life he led, huh? We may not always see the purpose for the things that we go through. But God, trust me, is not allowing these things to happen to us simply because he likes to see us suffer. There's a reason for it. We read in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28 that we know that all things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And I believe that one of the main purposes God has in leading us to the places that he does is for the purpose of us recognizing that he is the true God and breaking down all these false gods that we have. Because when you think about it, you know, Jesus said the two great commandments are, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your might, and love your neighbor as yourself. And if you don't love God with all your heart, which means to love God with all your heart simply means that you obey God, because your God is whatever you obey. You know, if you don't love God with all your heart, you're not going to love your neighbor. And that's what God is trying to teach us in this life, is to love one another, to be kind to other people, to consider other people, to treat other people right. And you can't do that if you don't love God. Because if you don't love God, it means that there's something else in your life you love, And you're going to get so fixated on that that you're going to run over people in your effort to get there. You know, when you drive on the freeway in Los Angeles, quite often you come across people who are so fixated on their goal of getting wherever they need to go, they are quite willing to run over you to get there, run you off the road. And I know I'm not alone in experiencing this. This is sort of a type of what people do in their lives. When we get our minds focused off of God and we get focused on some other thing that we think is more important, what happens is we run over people in symbolically. We don't treat other people right. This is why God leads us to places that He leads us, because He wants to learn us to learn the lesson that we must focus on Him. And in so doing, that will allow us to learn to love those of us around us. We may not see a purpose, but God sees a purpose in our lives and everything that He's doing. And sometimes God has to work with us over a long period of time and under severe circumstances for us to learn the lesson. For Herbert Armstrong, it took 28 years of poverty before he finally got to the point where that idol of wanting to be wealthy and wanting to be respected by other people and having material things finally was broken. Because he said if God had allowed it to end before then, he said the ego, the self in him would have sprang right back to life. That old man would have come right back. He would have been back where he was before. I'll tell you a story about a farmer. He had a well on his property that was dry and was uncovered, and he had a donkey, and the donkey fell into the well. And the farmer heard the donkey's cries, and he went and he looked down in the well, and he looked at how far down the donkey was, and he thought about how heavy that donkey was and how hard it would be to pull that donkey out of the well, and he just thought, you know, I just can't do it. It's just not worth it. That well just needs to be covered over anyway, filled in. So the farmer starts shoveling dirt into the well. Well, at first, the donkey cries even louder because he realizes, I'm being buried alive here. And that donkey is kind of like us sometimes. Sometimes life is shoveling dirt on top of us, and we feel sorry for ourselves, and we don't see the big picture of what's going on. But you know, a strange thing happened. After a little while of this, the donkey stopped crying. And the farmer thought, whoa, what's going on here? So he looked in the well, and he saw that the donkey, every time a shovel full of dirt would come down on his back, he would shake the dirt off, and then he would stamp it under his feet. And the donkey was getting higher and higher and higher, and eventually the donkey was high enough he walked out of the well. So when we don't see the big picture of what God is doing in our lives, and sometimes we probably won't until we're in the kingdom and look back, just remember the story of the donkey and shake it off, the dirt off, and step up. I told you in the beginning that not only can we learn lessons for our present lives to make sense of what God is doing with us now from this Exodus from Egypt, but we can also use it as a guidepost or a roadmap for the future. Because in Matthew 24, we read about a great tribulation that's coming on this earth. And we know that the peoples of this country and other Israelite nations in this world are once again going to be taken into a captivity and a slavery like the Israelites were back in Egypt. And God is going to once again deliver them. And once again, there are going to be plagues, just like there were back then. I mean, if you read in Revelation chapter 16, you read about there's going to be plagues of sores, kind of like the boils that they had in Egypt. There's going to be water turned to blood. There's going to be darkness. There's going to be huge hail, deadly hail. Plagues, again, coming on the earth. Let's go to Revelation chapter 12. Read a little bit about what's going to happen to the church. That would be us, among others. We read in Revelation chapter 12, verse 9, we read that the great dragon, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world, was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Verse 10, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Remember, he who seeks to save his life shall lose it, but he who loses his life for my sake shall find it. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows he has but a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman. The woman is the church, which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman, to the church, were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness. Once again, God is going to bear his church on eagle's wings into the wilderness, just like he did back then. Some have speculated that this, you know, being born on wings of an eagle means we're going to get on an airplane and fly someplace. I don't know. All I know is that the last time God said he bore on an eagle's wings, they had to walk. So, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and a half a time, so 3.5 years, a place of safety for the church from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman. So just like before, when the Israelites left Egypt and there was a great army that came after them to swallow them up, Satan is going to again try to swallow up the people of God, the church of God. But you know what? Just as God used the forces of nature and the earth to crush that army, again, we read, and the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened up her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. These things are not too far away. I think we are closer to the end of this civilization than we may realize. And once again, there's going to be an exodus of God's people. God tells us, come out of her and be you separate. And we understand that in the sense of an everyday command, that every day, even though we live in this world, we're not to be a part of it. But there's coming a time shortly when it's going to be literal. We are going to be literally taken out of this civilization and moved to a place that's a place of safety. And God's going to protect us, just like he did with the Israelites. So I think it behooves us to think about the lessons of what happened when those ancient Israelites were delivered by God. First of all, they had to recognize who the true God was. Couldn't have any other gods before him. They had to be willing to work at it. Who knows what hardships we might have to endure during this. And third, we must be willing to go wherever it is that God leads us. I hope this has been helpful, and I hope that as we go through the 7 days of unleavened bread that we reflect on the lessons and the story of the Exodus, and that we remember these three things that we have to do in our lives on a daily basis. We got to remember who the true God is, recognize him, not allow any other gods to come before him. Be willing to work at it, and be willing to go wherever it is that God leads us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at the Eternal Church of God, P.O. Box 4063, Sunland, California, zip code 91041. Or you may call us toll-free at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at www.eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.